ordered myself a pitcher and picked up the box of cards sitting on the table. They were old Trivial Pursuit cards, so I spent the next hour playing myself in trivia and guzzling Miller Lite. I was in the midst of doing all the history questions when a man approached my table and took the seat across from me. After staring at him for a good second, I said, "What year did Panama purchase the Panama Canal from the United States?" He took two or three chomps and said, 1963. I say 1967. I turned the card over. 1963. Ethan raised his eyebrows. I said, "Isn't that the year you graduated high school?" Ethan, who was only a couple years older than me, ignored this remark. Currently, he was flagging down a server. One came over and he ordered a scotch and water. He said, "So, what did you do today, Thomas?" I had a good suspicion Ethan knew exactly what I did today. I'm sure Ace and Gary had briefed him of my daily activities. I spent the day looking for Seattle Memorial. I wanted to ask Dr. McSteamy a couple questions about my prostate. He showed no reaction to my jest, and come to think of it, I don't know if I'd ever seen the guy laugh. But then again, maybe he didn't watch Grey's Anatomy. Maybe he was a big people, small world kind of guy. He smirked and said, "Actually, I heard through the grapevine that you went to the Capitol building, had a little sit-down, made a pit stop at the library, then took a little trip to the mountains. That sound about right? I went to Arby's, too, got a beef and cheddar and a jamocha shake." He ignored this and asked, "Now, what interest could you possibly have in the U.S. Fish and Wildlife building?" That, of course, was the million-dollar question. "I'm writing a paper about the mating rituals of the muskox." He took a sip of scotch, smacked his lips, and said, "Did you know that Riley Peterson, the woman you may or may not have brutally murdered, worked for the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service?" It never came up. That's hard to believe. Outlandish lies usually are. I was starting to get fed up with my buddy Ethan, and I said, "What the fuck do you want, Ethan?" "I want you to pack up and leave, Prescott. Shit. I don't care if you did kill that poor girl. You get out of town, and I'll make sure the whole thing disappears." He noticed my reaction and said, "Don't think I put that case to rest. And if I wanted to, I could arrest you right now for sticking your nose in an official investigation. But I'd rather see you locked up for a while, see you do some real hard time. I spoke with one of the district attorneys not 10 minutes ago. He found a case, actually multiple cases, where evidence found in a relative's house was deemed admissible. You can expect to be arrested in the next 48 hours, and there isn't a fucking thing your piece of shit lawyer can do to help you this time." I drained half my beer and thought about what Ethan had said. Now, I did not think for a second I would get convicted of murder, especially when I knew exactly who had committed the murder. But this was my ace, and I wasn't sure if I wanted to play it at all, least of all now, being that I was considering killing the man with my bare hands who killed Ellen and Riley. But I didn't like the thought of being arrested a second time, or sitting in the interrogation room, or standing trial if it came to that. Ethan downed his scotch but said nothing. Then he grabbed for the pitcher and filled up his rocks glass with my Miller Lite. He smiled and said, "Now get the next one." Wow, just like college. Although the thought of splitting a pitcher of beer with Ethan Cates ranked right up there with getting my dick caught in my zipper. But the idea of leaving town still beckoned. "So you're saying, if I just disappear, I'm clear. You're clear. Of everything. Of everything. Wipe the slate clean." He smiled. "You just have to promise not to come back. Put that house of your sister's up on the market and never come back. My cousin is a real estate agent. I'll give you his card." He had quite the sales pitch. I could tell him what I knew about the professor, let him run with that, and I'd be on the next plane to France. Shit, the market was good. The house would go upward of $1 million, and I could forget about Washington forever. There was an easy solution to this. "I'll play 18 holes for it." "Golf?" I cocked my head at the golden tee machine in the corner and said, "18 holes right now. You win, I pack my bags and catch the next flight out. I win, I stay. I do my job, you do yours, and fuck all the rest." He knew exactly what was on the line here. I was saying if I won, I could find out who killed Riley and deal with it myself, and I would. I would go home, clean off my dad's old shotgun, drive up to the mountains again, shoot the professor in his gross-ass face, and feed him to his friends. And if he won, I would be on the next flight to France. Ethan had a bit of a competitive streak in him. We used to play on an inter-squad basketball league on Tuesday nights. Everybody else was just out to have a good time, and Ethan was running around like he's friggin' Richard Hamilton. He winked at me and said, "You're on." Ethan picked the course. He was somewhere in Maui, and there were a bunch of orange spots on all the holes. I pointed to one of the orange blobs and said, "What are those?" "Lava pits." "Great. The third time in my life I play Golden Tee, I'm playing for the right to not move to France, and he picks the course with the lava pits." The first hole was a long par four, the dog-legged right. Ethan went first. He hit a perfect drive down the middle of the fairway, a good 300 yards. I had a feeling Ethan had played his fair share of Golden Tee. "Hello, Air France, it's Thomas, s'il vous plaît. I noticed that if you cut across the lava pits, you could reach the green in one. I took two steps back and hit the ball as hard as I could. My ball landed perfectly on the green, then bounced off, hit the lava rock, then went into a lava pit. The screen notified me of a two-stroke penalty. Ethan took a long drink to mask his smile. He went on to get a birdie. I got an 11. Yeah, I decided I wanted to see what the lava was like twice more. For the record, it's hot, like magma. Over the course of the next 17 holes, Ethan and I polished off two more pitchers. Ethan went in the lava once. I went in the lava 32 times. My player even fell in the lava once, which I didn't know was possible. I incurred a 5-stroke penalty and had to put in another dollar. When it was over, I shook Ethan's hand. He pulled out his cell phone and handed it to me. After about 10 minutes, I had booked a flight to Charles de Gaulle Airport. One way. Ethan called his cousin and we spoke briefly about the property. He said he would take care of everything. I knew Lacey would be okay with it. Ethan and I took a shot of expensive scotch and clinked glasses to my departure. I'm not sure who was happier. Ace and Gary drove me home. They were coming back at 8 in the morning to take me to the airport. I flopped down on the couch and passed out. Chapter 44. The knocking was back. I pushed myself off the couch with a grunt. I was no longer drunk, and I was yet to be hungover. I was in that limbo period, like when Billy Joel wakes up inside the house, inside his car. I walked into the kitchen and took a long drink from the faucet. It wasn't quite as satisfying as a blue Powerade with a sports top, but my tongue no longer felt like it was wearing a turban. The clock above the stove told me it was 4 in the morning. As I shuffled to the door, the events of the previous evening started to slowly come back. I vaguely remembered playing a game of Golden Tee for my right to stay in the great state of Washington, a game I believe I went on to lose by 47 strokes. Friggin' lava. I had a feeling it was either Ace or Gary on the other side of the door, or both. Ethan had probably sent them over to help me pack my bags. I pulled the door open. It wasn't Ace or Gary. I gave a quick nod and said, "Hey." Erica gave a little smile. "I heard you were leaving." I pondered asking her how she'd come across such sensitive information, but the odds were that she either called Ethan or Ethan called her, or she read my blog. "My flight is in about 6 hours." Erica was wearing tight jeans and a gray sweatshirt, as well as her pink ball cap. She had her hands stuffed down in her pockets and her head cocked to the side. My mouth went dry and my stomach churned. Was it her? Was it the alcohol? I wasn't certain what words I wanted to say, or what words she wanted to hear. I was going to call. "Were you now?" "Yeah, from the airphone." I mimicked sliding my credit card, then dialing, then wrapping the long cord around the guy coughing incessantly next to me. She tried not to laugh, but it was impossible because I am hilarious. The next few minutes were going to be tricky. For one, I was still slightly tipsy, and I tended to make bad decisions when I was slightly tipsy. That's how I'd ended up engaged. That's how I'd fallen for Alex. That's how I'd sat through the new world. That's how I'd ended up with a timeshare in Arkansas. And that's how I'd ended up with a one-way ticket to France. We stared at each other for a couple long seconds. I took a step to the side and said, "Do you want to come in?" She hesitated for a second, then walked past me into the house. I said, "Can I offer you something to drink? I have hot water or cold water." "I'm good, thanks." About halfway to the kitchen, Erica turned and said, "I'm off the case, you know." I did not know. Ethan said he didn't think I could handle the magnitude of this case. Then he went and told the chief that somehow you were clouding my judgment, that my naivete was cause for both you and Adam Gray having charges dismissed against you. I took a step forward and said, "Well, is he right? Have I clouded your judgment?" There are a few times I've found myself being serious, and this was one of those times. I needed to hear it from her. needed to hear how she felt. This was Thomas Prescott at his very worst. I could feel my heart, my brain, my insides seeping out from my pores. Okay, so there's a good chance it was Ethel, but you get my drift. Girls call it wearing your heart on your sleeve. Dr. Phil calls it being vulnerable. Guys call it being a pussy. She shook her head. You never clouded my judgment. Not for a second. It was always about Ellen Gray. It still is. And concerning Riley, I told the chief you may be a moron, but you weren't a murderer. Thanks for the endorsement. I did a U-turn, walked to the door, and held it open. I'll send you a postcard. She stood in the foyer. I think she was waiting to see if I was serious. I was. It took a moment for Erica to take her first step. After the first, the second and third came quickly. I yelled, "Wait a minute." She turned. "I have something I need to tell you." She took a couple steps forward. I had two separate things I wanted to tell her. It was one or the other. If I told her one thing, I would end up staying, and staying meant jail time and possibly some man-on-man time, which the more I thought about it, the less I was enthused about. And if I told her the other thing, I put into concrete that I was getting on a plane in 5 hours. I mentally flipped a coin. It was heads. I said, "Wolves." She wrinkled her nose and said, "Wolves?" I nodded. She raised her eyebrows. This whole thing was about wolves. Ellen, Riley, Adam, me. It was all about wolves. She took a step forward. I spent the next 10 minutes walking Erica through what happened, or what I was nearly certain happened. When I finished, her head was shaking. "Holy shit." "Yeah. What are you going to do?" "I just did it." "You're leaving this up to me?" "Not a whole lot I can do from France. You could always stay." I told Erica about the bet. She found this just the least bit ridiculous. She asked, "Why would you make such a stupid bet?" "Seemed like a great idea at the time." "And what? You suck at golden tea or something?" "My guy kept falling in the lava." "Lava?" "Long story short, I lost." She took a deep breath and said, "What should I do?" It took me a moment to realize she was talking about the professor. "That's up to you." "But I'm off the case." "So you say." She was quiet for a minute, biting into her bottom lip. She looked at me, and I knew the question before she asked it. "What would you do?" "You really want to know?" She nodded. "I'd rip out what's left of his throat and shoot him in both kneecaps. That's a big help. I'm a problem solver." She spent the next 5 minutes trying to convince me to stay, that the two of us could do it together. When she was done, I said, "I can't." She nodded. I could see her eyes getting all misty, and I told her I should really get packing. Although in reality, all I had to do was grab my wallet. Mostly I wanted Erica off my doorstep. I wanted her to stop looking at me with her perfect eyes, her devious smile, and I needed her to stop biting her lip. She told me to look her up when I got back, and I broke the news that, according to the small print of the aforementioned ridiculous bet, I wasn't ever allowed back. We said our goodbyes, the way people do when they know they'll never cross paths again. Chapter 45. The airport was busy for a Thursday morning. I found the line to the security checkpoint and looked at a wall clock. I had an hour before the flight boarded. I glanced around at families and friends waiting on the outskirts to say their final goodbyes. I half expected to see Erica. I didn't. I did happen to see Ace and Gary, both drinking coffees and throwing glances in my direction every so often. I guess they'd been under orders to see this through to the very end. I saluted them and they saluted back. Project Prescott was finally over. I wondered what they were going to do to celebrate. "Wrap it up, boys." An hour and a half later, I watched as the city I flew into just 6 weeks earlier disappeared beneath me. I could have gotten introspective, thought about the irony of the situation, pondered how I had come to Seattle to escape a problem, and now I was leaving Seattle for the same reason. But I was too tired to get introspective. I fell asleep before the cart lady came around. As I was killing 2 hours at Cincinnati International, it dawned on me that if I showed up on Lacey's doorstep without Christmas presents, she would flip. I'd explained to her about how I'd lost her presents in a melee that concluded with me having a collapsed lung, but I'm not sure she bought the story. So I checked out a couple of the shops in the airport. I got her an Ohio Landscapes calendar, an Ohio State hoodie, and an Ocho Cinco jersey. As I boarded the plane for the 10-hour nonstop flight to France, I noticed the passenger makeup was predominantly French and American business people, coming and going. A handful of college kids filled the other seats, no doubt heading to Europe to do a couple weeks of backpacking, hostel jumping, and poor decision-making. I was sandwiched between a businessman and a young girl with about 70 piercings. She had a beanie, an iPod, and a black hooded sweatshirt to complete the punk look. As the plane took off, I found that I wasn't as excited as I thought I'd be, or should be, for that matter. Here I was headed to one of the most exotic cities in the world, about to be reunited with the only family I'd left, about to get a fresh start, and all I could think about was Erica Frost. I couldn't see her taking the information I'd relayed to her and passing it on to the proper people, specifically Ethan Cates. But then again, that's exactly why I told her and not him. I wanted her to get the bust, but Erica was a rogue, one of the very reasons I was drawn to her, and I highly doubted she would alert anyone to the course she set, which, if it were me, would be to drive directly to the North Cascades and haul that shitbag in. I pulled out the airphone and tried all four of Erica Frost's phone numbers. I got four no answers. I placed the receiver back and let out a sigh. There was a solid chance the only person who knew Erica Frost's whereabouts was about halfway over the Atlantic Ocean. We landed at Charles de Gaulle Airport at 1:04 p.m. local time, or about 5:04 a.m. Seattle time. I walked from the plane and into the corridor. I spotted the punk girl leaning against a wall. She was now wearing a large backpack, covered with different buttons and patches. She threw me a dismissive glance as I approached. I mimed taking off my headphones. She did. I said, "Hi, I was wondering if you could do me a favor." She scoffed. "I'm not going to blow you if that's what you're wondering." I looked around. I thought about turning and running. She added, "At least not here." I raised my eyebrows and said, "Not the favor I was thinking of, but thank you." I told her what I wanted her to do and handed her the bag. I took out a pen and wrote the address on her hand. Then I took $500 out of my wallet and handed it to her. As I turned to leave, she said, "My offer still stands." I told her maybe next time and found the nearest ticket desk. I spent the better part of the next day sleeping and brushing up on my celebrity relationship knowledge. 16 hours later, the pilot came on the intercom and said, "Welcome to Seattle. The local time is 9:23 p.m. The temperature is 18 degrees and it's snowing." He paused, then added, "Actually, it's blizzarding." They grounded all outgoing flights as of 10 p.m. and began redirecting incoming flights to smaller airports in parts of southern Washington and northern Oregon as of 10:30 p.m. This, of course, was according to 10:90 a.m., the station my taxi driver, Bernard, had the stereo tuned to. The snow was coming down in drifts, the traffic at a near standstill, and it took 2 hours for the taxi to reach my house. Sitting just on the outskirts of my gate, partially blanketed by a fresh coat of snow, was a for sale sign. Well, this guy didn't mess around. I pulled the sign out from the frozen earth and laid it on the ground. Inside the house, I checked my machine. There was one message. It was from Lacey. She was a tad confused when a punk rocker chick had showed up at her doorstep and handed her a bag of presents, which all appeared to be purchased in the great state of Ohio, and said that they were from her brother. Needless to say, she wanted me to call her back immediately. Unfortunately, there were more pressing matters at hand. I picked up the phone and tried all four of Erica's numbers. All four went unanswered. I found myself saying out loud, "Where are you, Erica Frost?" But again, I knew exactly where she was. I only hoped she was alone.
Chapter 46. When I settled in behind the wheel of the large four-wheel drive, it was closing in on 1 a.m. The snow was coming down at a steep angle, an endless sea of large white flakes. I turned on the radio, tuned it to 10:90 a.m., and listened to the forecast. The system was moving down from the mountains, and they were calling for at least another foot in the city. They listed a number of road closures and counties on accident alert. It sounded as if the entire city was making arrangements to shut down for the next couple days. They were even predicting the NFC Championship game would be postponed, seeing as how the Arizona Cardinals flight had been canceled. On a side note, State Road 20, also known as North Cascades Highway, had been listed among the roads closed. This, of course, could throw a hitch in my rescue mission. The plows are running on the highway, and I drafted behind one of the large trucks. I wouldn't exactly quantify the storm as a whiteout, but visibility was down to about 20 feet. After an hour of averaging speeds between 7 and 15 miles per hour, I came to the junction to the North Cascades Highway. Three snowplows, their lights blinking, blocked off the incoming traffic. I pulled up near the trucks. A man setting up roadblocks walked over. He had a thick jacket on with the hood pulled up and ski goggles. I rolled the window down and the man said, "Road's closed, pal." I yelled into the wind, "Listen, I have to get up there." I made up some story about my wife going into labor. I took out my badge, well, Todd Gregory's badge, and flashed it to him. He said, "I wish I could help you, pal, but your car just isn't going to make it. This is the first wave of the storm. The second wave is rolling down from Canada as we speak. They think this one could set records, calling for like 4 or 5 feet. This was what I was afraid of. I was little help if my car got stuck, or if I drove off the side of the mountain, or got caught in an avalanche, which weren't exactly rare in these glacial mountains. The guy seemed genuinely concerned, far more concerned than I would have been for a total stranger. He asked, "How far up you going?" "Not too far." I could see he was contemplating driving me up there. He knew the roads and he knew the weather. But was he going to put his ass on the line? I started to think he might. I was wrong. He said, "Sorry, pal, I can't help you." Wrong answer. I opened up the glove compartment and pulled out my father's Smith & Wesson. I pointed the gun at the man's face. "I'm not asking anymore, pal." He actually softened quite quickly. He handed me the keys, walked me over to the plow, and gave me a quick crash course. I was set to leave, and I said, "One more thing." He looked at me skeptically. "I need your goggles." The plow ripped through the snow, and I made decent time. Every half mile or so, I would come across a car on the side of the road. There were even two cars parked in the middle of the road. I wondered where the occupants were. If I weren't on a time crunch, I might have stopped and made sure no one was trying to stave off death inside the vehicles. As I persevered up the mountain, the snow continued to let up. But you could see the damage the first wave had done. More than a foot of fresh snow as far as the eye could see. An hour later, the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Building came into view. There were two cars. One was parked where Herb had parked his Jeep the day we'd met, and I assumed this was his car. The other was parked on the far side of the lot, and the snow cloud it was in resembled a sedan. I ran to the car and brushed off the license plate. It was Erica's. I wondered how long the car had been parked there. Probably close to 36 hours. Shit. I grabbed my things from the plow and made my way into the building. I called out to Herb, but I had a feeling he wasn't around. He was either snowed in somewhere or with Erica, which, if the latter was true, means there was a good chance Herb was dead. I changed into my winter gear. It was slim pickings. My father's old ski gear was a pretty ridiculous old full-body snowsuit. Lime green, magenta, and yellow stripes ran down the length of the arms and legs. I went into the office and snagged the remaining power bars and a couple bottled waters and stuffed them in one of the many zippered pockets. I pulled open a locker and found an emergency rescue kit. I opened it and pulled out a flare gun, which I stuffed snugly beneath the belt of the snowsuit. I also took one of three flashlights and stuck it next to the flare gun. As I was leaving, I eyed the rifle resting in the corner. The snub-nosed revolver I'd used in my plowjacking hadn't been loaded. Guns without bullets only get you so far. I picked up the rifle and checked the barrel. Loaded. I made my way to the door and opened it to a wall of white. The second wave of the storm had arrived. Chapter 47. Two of the three snowmobiles were missing. I wondered what Erica's plan had been. Had she planned to escort the deranged professor back on the snowmobile? Or make him ski in front of her while she trained her 9mm at the back of his head? And what about Herb? Had he chaperoned Erica on her endeavor? And if so, were either of them still alive? I wiped the excess snow off the snowmobile and found the key in the ignition. A bungee cord was attached to the back of the sled, and I secured the rifle as best I could. I hit the ignition and the machine roared to life. I pulled my goggles down, pulled back on the throttle, and the snowmobile lurched forward. The snow was falling at an incredible pace. I could barely see my own hands in front of me. After 20 minutes, I figured I was about halfway there. Then I heard the unthinkable. The engine beneath me sputtered. I wiped the dash and peered at the gas gauge. Empty. The snowmobile coughed, waned, then died. I may have cursed. I hopped off the sled and into the snow. The snow came up to above my knees.
I figured that at the rate it was falling, in an hour, it would be up to my waist. There were a large set of boulders to my right, and I remembered the den was about a mile in that direction. After 10 minutes, my chest was heaving. I'm not sure if it was the material the snowsuit was composed of, or if I'd accidentally lit myself on fire with the flare gun, but my body temp was hovering around 5,000 degrees. I kept on for another 20 minutes, then stopped. I looked in every direction. It was a sea of white. I was lost. I thought about doubling back, but I wasn't really sure which way back was. And over the course of the last 10 minutes, the snow had intensified, if that was possible. I put my head down and forged ahead. I didn't see the fence until it was literally a foot in front of me. I followed the fence with my hands until I came to the gate. It was open. I took 10 trudges through the gate, half expecting a wolf to latch onto my throat at any moment. I continued through the snow, the faint outline of the barn slowly coming into focus. As I approached the barn, I noticed a silhouette of something 30 yards in front of the small building. I came abreast of it. It was a snowmobile. I instinctively dusted off the gas gauge and took a peek, nearly full. I took a step past the sled and stopped. My mouth went dry. A large pile of pink snow was directly underfoot. Sitting amid the pile was a brimmed hat. My stomach fell. If Herb was dead, it didn't bode well for Erica. My throat tightened as I trudged the final steps to the barn. It was unlocked. It was at about this point that it dawned on me I'd left the rifle attached to the snowmobile. Awesome. I figured if I did come across the professor, which was a long shot, I had a feeling he was skiing around with his wolf buddies. Maybe I could smash him over the head with a power bar or something. And I did have the flare gun, but if you've ever seen a flare gun, you know they aren't the most reliable of devices, or accurate. Even so, I pulled it from my waist and pushed the door open. The acrid smell of wildlife filled my nostrils, and I gave my head a stiff shake. It was dark, and I pulled the goggles up. I let my eyes adjust, then pushed through the door leading to the holding cells. The sound of hooves and deep breathing echoed through the small chamber. The clatter grew louder and louder as the animals thrashed about. The small room was an acoustical chamber, the sounds echoing through the soft wood. It was deafening. I held the flashlight up high with my left hand and the flare gun in front of me with my right. On each side of the room were 5 holding pens, 10 places for someone to hide, 10 places for someone to spring from and send a cartridge of ketamine into my back or neck. I said, "Hey, Professor, I saw this infomercial the other night. It was for this cream that covers up disgusting abnormalities, like the one growing on your face." He didn't respond, because he wasn't in the room, or because he didn't want to blow his cover, or because he had seen the same infomercial, I wasn't sure. I leaned over the first stall, but other than 2 or 3 large piles of shit, it was empty. I turned around and did the same with the stall on my right side. Again, nothing. I took a deep breath. 8 to go. I shined the flashlight on the 2nd stall on the left and peered over the edge. Empty. I could hear deep rustling from the stall on the right. I peered over the edge of it and saw a large deer huddled in the far corner. I shined the light in its face and its eyes disappeared into 2 white chasms. I watched as its ears fluttered and nose flared. I said, "It's gonna be all right, buddy. I'm not here for you. I'm here for the professor. You don't happen to know where he is, do you?" The deer cocked his head to the right and said, "I saw the professor duck into the last stall on the right. Hey, I haven't heard from Dave in a while." I didn't have the heart to tell him he wouldn't be getting a Christmas card from Dave come next year. Due to the intense heat of the snowsuit, compounded with the high stress level of my present situation, and the fact that Herb was dead and Erica had most likely met a similar fate, and multiplied by 2 days of jet lag, this all added up to my having an imaginary conversation with a fucking deer. I shook my head and moved up to the next row, both vacant. I could hear movement in at least 2 of the last 4 cubbies. I checked the one on the left. I saw something scurry across the floor, but it was either a rat or a mouse, which, other than bringing to mind a discovery special I'd seen on the hantavirus, didn't overly concern me. I turned to the right and stared at the 2nd-to-last stall. Something was definitely behind that wall. I took a deep breath, fingered the trigger on the flare gun, and took a step toward the wooden door. My face was inches from a line of sight when something sprang up on the door. I fell backwards, instinctively pulling the trigger on the gun. The flare erupted, whizzing from the gun, filling the small room with supernova-quality illumination. I shielded my eyes and pushed myself backwards on the dirt floor.
I pulled the goggles down to block the light and crawled to the edge of the stall, slowly climbing up on the wooden planks. I gingerly peeked over the edge. A large elk lay on its side, thrashing about. The flare was sticking out of its chest, spurting white-hot flames. Both the elk and half the stall were on fire. Good grief. Not one to dawdle, I peeked over the stall next to the burning elk, empty. Then I moved quickly to the other side and gazed into the last stall. I took a deep breath. In the back right corner was Erica. Her eyes found mine. There was duct tape over her mouth, but I knew she was smiling. On closer examination, I saw that she was handcuffed, the cuffs slinking beneath a piece of wood framing that divided the stalls. I pulled the door open and crawled to her. She raised her eyebrows. I pulled the tape off her mouth gingerly. I could have mouthed the words with her. "You're my hero. You saved my life. You came back for me." She said none of these things. She did say, "Who are you?" I lifted the goggles. Her eyebrows rose. After a short pause, she said, "Why are you dressed like that?" "It's a long story." She sniffed a couple times. I thought she was starting to get emotional. She said, "I think I smell smoke." Then again, maybe not. I brushed a strand of hair out of her eyes and said, "I accidentally lit the place on fire." Her eyes widened. I could feel an intense heat on my back and I'd turned. I'd say 2/3 of the place was engulfed in flames. This could get messy. I asked, "Where are the keys to the cuffs?" "Do you really think if I knew the answer to that question, I would be in this position?" "Valid point." The smoke was starting to get thick, and I said, "Lie down." She did, her hands outstretched. I took 2 steps back and kicked the wooden divider with my foot. Nothing happened. I kicked 3 more times. I was getting dizzy from the fumes, and I was having trouble keeping my balance. I kicked a 4th time and felt a slight shudder. On the 7th kick, there was a loud crack, and the divider fell 6 inches. My eyes had started to water, and I could barely breathe. I figured we had about 1 minute left before we both passed out from the carbon monoxide. I took 3 steps back and smashed into the divider, like Steve Atwater, into Christian Okoye. A loud crack echoed through the room, and the divider fell to the floor. I stamped on the 2x4 until it snapped in half. Erica pulled the cuffs around the wood, then stood. We both turned. The flames were everywhere, a wall of fire. I knew there was a door just to the left where Riley had ushered out the deer, but we were going to have to go through the fire. I said, "Get on my back." She wrapped the handcuffs around my head and hopped on my back. "Ready?" She dug her head in my back. I covered my face with my arm and ran into the flames, smashed through the door, took 3 large steps, then dove into the snow. After we both exhausted our coughing fits, I mustered, "Are you okay?" "I think so." We lay there for a couple seconds, gathering our breath. The heat was intense. We both stood and began trudging away from the billowing building. The snow had let up by half, and visibility was 50 or 60 yards. We were closing in on the snowmobile when I looked at Erica and said, "Now tell me what happened." "After you left, there were 2 loud cracks. I dragged Erica to the snow. The bullets just missed us, cutting through the base of the snowmobile. Erica said, "What was the..." I put my finger to my lips and peeked over the edge of the snowmobile. Through the blur of the snow just outside the fence was a man dressed in all white, a man holding a very familiar-looking rifle, the professor. Chapter 48. I climbed on the large snowmobile and yelled, "Get on!" Erica jumped on the back and once again draped her arms over my head, the metal cuffs settling in around my waist. As I started the snowmobile, I gave a quick look over my shoulder, but the professor was gone. I took a deep breath, relaxed, tried to formulate some sort of plan. That's when I saw the light. It moved slowly through the blanket of snow in the direction of the gate. It was blinding and moving fast. It appeared the professor had swapped out the skis for a snowmobile. Uh-oh. Erica pinched me and said, "Go!" Riley had mentioned a 2nd gate at the far edge of the den. If that was open, we stood a chance. If it was closed, we would be dead. We zipped through the deep snow. The far side of the fencing came into view. It took a moment to locate the gate. It wasn't easy to spot because it was closed. I looked over my shoulder. The professor was gaining on us, maybe 50 yards behind. I thought about cutting it into the trees or circling back around to the other gate, but he'd cut us off at the angle either way. I yelled, "Hold on!" "Why?" "Just hold on tight!" I didn't want to tell her that I was going to bash through the gate. In the movies, this would be no problem. But this wasn't the movies.
If the gate was locked with a thick chain and padlock as the other gate had been, this wouldn't end pretty. Lots of loose steel, loose parts, and loose limbs. I was banking on the hinges. They were relatively cheap on metal fencing, and with the intense cold, I was hoping they would snap easily. The gate was 20 yards away. Erica yelled, "There's a fence!" Then 10, "Are you crazy?" 5, "What are you?" I closed my eyes and stiffened. There was a loud crack, then a jolt. I opened my eyes and was surprised to see that I was still alive. Erica yelled, "Are you fucking serious? You could have warned me." "I did. I told you to hang on." I looked behind us. The gate hung limply by a single hinge, and more importantly, the professor had slowed to maneuver around the gate. "Take that, diehard." We started down a steep hill. We were in a valley, and it was white as far as the eye could see. The snowmobile was making an odd clicking sound. I brushed my hand over the control panel and noticed for the second time that the snowmobile was running on empty. One of those bullets must have ripped through the gas tank. I said, "We have a problem." "No shit, Sherlock." "Okay, we have a couple problems." I leaned forward and said, "We're about to run out of gas. Find a hill." She must have taken auto mechanics in high school. Most gas tanks have their drip in the rear. That's why when you run out of gas, it's usually on something of a decline. I leaned forward. "Here's what we're going to do." I laid the plan out for her. She nodded. It was our only hope. We hit a trough and started up an incline. The crest was about 200 yards away and littered with pine trees. I asked, "Where is he?" I could feel her turn around, the cuffs tightening around my waist. She turned back. "I can just barely see a shadow moving down the hill." We were fast approaching the crest, 50 yards away, when the engine first coughed. Erica leaned back and yelled, "Left or right?" The engine coughed twice more. I yelled, "Left." We both situated ourselves on the left side of the snowmobile. We hit the crest. I had just enough time to take in the outlay of the hill, a steep decline with very few trees. We had a fighting chance that the snowmobile would make it to the bottom of the long hill and then some. We just had to pray the professor didn't notice it didn't have any occupants. I screamed, "Now!" We dove left. The deep powder cushioned our blow and we sank deep. We dove near a series of trees, and the snow shaken from the branches gave cover to the large hole amidst the untouched powder. Erica's arms were still wrapped around my waist, so she couldn't do much. I said, "Count to 10. "Okay." I started digging, covering us with as much snow as possible. Within 2 short seconds, it was pitch dark. I pulled snow from beneath us and packed it above us, entrenching us in an ice cavern. Erica whispered, 10. I stopped. I could feel my heartbeat thudding against my ribs. My throat began to tighten. I took deep breaths through my nose. I wasn't exactly claustrophobic, but I wasn't too fond of close quarters. Then I heard the slight vibrations, a quivering that ran through the ground. Erica's hands clenched to my chest. The soft tones of the motor came next, slight at first, then strong and swift. I could feel the snowmobile inch its way up the crest of the small hill. The sounds carried through the cold snow, like a boat's propeller through a silent pool. Just when I thought the sounds, the reverberations, had reached their pinnacle, they grew louder, stronger. I could visualize the professor taking stock of his surroundings. We weren't being followed. We were being hunted. The seconds ticked by. Why was he still here? Why hadn't he started down the hill? Had he noticed the snowmobile was empty? The noise was deafening, the vibrations numbing. He couldn't have been more than a couple feet away. Then the snowmobile went quiet. I clung to Erica. A thud. The professor was off the snowmobile. He was behind us and to the right. I whispered, "He must have seen something." "Shh, right. Be quiet." I paused for a second, then said, "You be quiet." The squish-squish of the professor's footsteps came steadily closer. He was walking around his snowmobile. He took 2 steps and stopped. Erica's fingers clawed at my chest and I could feel her body stiffen. He took another step. I flexed every muscle in my body so as not to move. I could feel his leg drive downward in the snow. His foot came down on my foot. I slinked my foot up as far as possible. I could hear his foot moving around, searching for whatever he'd stepped on. I wouldn't have been surprised if he just started firing into the snow. He stood there for 3 seconds, then 5. I thought about using the element of surprise and going for him. In fact, if his leg had been anywhere near one of my arms, I would have. But I had a 110-pound bag of potatoes strapped to my back. Then his leg slipped from the snow. The squishes faded. The engine fired. The professor was gone.
Chapter 49. We waited a good minute before we moved. Erica whispered, "You think it's safe?" There was a fine line between not waiting long enough and waiting too long. If the professor did come back, I wanted to put as much distance between us and the surrounding area as possible. It was only a matter of time before he noticed that wherever the snowmobile did come to rest, no footprints led away from it, and he would begin to backtrack. When he did, I wanted to be at the closest Comfort Inn. I said, "Yeah, I think we're good." I swept the snow from above us and we sat up. I peered down the mountain. Two sets of fresh snowmobile tracks shot directly down and out of sight. I let out a long sigh. Although, as I think the cliche goes, we weren't out of the woods quite yet. We stood up. The cuffs were still wrapped around my waist, and I turned so they were now around my back. It was a tight fit, and Erica's large chest was squishing into my stomach. Erica was staring at my chest, afraid to look up. I leaned my head down until it was touching hers. I gave her cheek a light nudge. She slowly lifted her head until her magical eyes were staring into mine. Her lips flexed into a meek smile, and her chest moved slowly in and out. In, out. In, out. I moved my cheek gently across her neck. I ran my lips near her perfect ear, across her soft cheek. She tilted her head up, and I brushed lightly against her supple top lip. Time stopped. She moved the cuffs up my back until her hands found the back of my head. Her lips welcomed mine, her silky tongue timidly exploring every inch of my tongue. I don't know how long the kiss lasted, nor did I care to know. We stayed that way for a while. At one point, Erica pulled away and licked her lips. I was in love, again. Erica broke away and said, "Not that I don't thoroughly enjoy this, but I think we should get moving." "Oh, right, that guy is trying to kill us, isn't he?" She nodded silently. I think she said a quick prayer that the kids would get my eyes and not my personality. Or maybe she was having kisser's remorse. Either way, she was right. Erica pulled the cuffs up and over my head. Then she pulled me down for another kiss, just a quick one. They say it's all in the first kiss. They're wrong. It's the second kiss that matters most, and in this case, the earth shook. We gave one last look around us and took off. Trudging through the deep snow took its toll, and we were forced to take a break after 20 minutes. We worked our way into a deep set of trees, which would be nearly impossible to negotiate on a snowmobile, and plopped down. I extracted the bottle of water and two power bars from zipper pocket number 7E. I handed Erica a bar and said, "You want to tell me what happened?" Erica took the bar and ripped off the wrapper. She took a huge bite and forced it down, then gobbled up the remainder. She eyed the half-eaten bar in my hand and said, "You gonna eat that?" I had been thinking about it. I handed over the bar and said, "I had a Cinnabon 30 hours ago. I'm stuffed." She ignored me, attacking the second power bar. I thought about telling her she was almost out of her Atkins points for the day, but I typically like to date girls for at least a month before I give them dieting advice. She polished off the bar, swigged down the bottle of water, let out a deep breath and said, "Much better." I nodded. She closed her eyes for a second as if remembering. "So after I left your house, I was pissed off. Actually, I was really pissed off at you and myself, at the world." She paused. I think she wanted me to chime in that I shouldn't have let it end the way it had. I said no such thing. She started back up. "My plan was to call Ethan, tell him everything you told me, then go to the grocery store and clean out their Ben and Jerry section." Ethan answered, and before I could tell him anything, he told me he knew that I'd just come from your house and that he just got off the phone with the chief. I was officially on probation. This put me over the edge, and I told him that he and the chief could go to hell for all I cared. "Let me guess, you didn't tell him about the wolves." She shook her head. "I went home, slept for a couple hours, then drove to the mountains. I got up here and thought it was a dead end. There wasn't anybody around. I sat in my car for a good hour. Then this car pulls up and this big black guy steps out. Herb. You met him? About 6'6", 250. Talks like an Oxford-educated Bubba Gump." She nodded. "I hate to tell you this, but Herb was, how do I put this? Devoured." Erica gulped. "And I have a feeling if I hadn't come to your rescue, you would have met the same fate." She smiled, crawled the 2 feet to me, and planted a fat one on me. She said, quite sarcastically, mind you, "My hero." "So you met Herb," she crawled back. "Right.
Then I pretty much told him what you told me. When I mentioned Riley, he got sort of choked up. She paused for a second. I think she wanted to see if I would have a similar reaction. The crime scene photo of Riley flashed across my eyes and my stomach tightened. Not at the sight of her dead, but at the idea of what I was imagining doing to the professor. I won't bore you with the details, but I will tell you that the professor's testicles were no longer dangling peacefully from his scrotum. You all right? I was anything but all right. But Erica wanted to hear that I was all right, so I told her I was. She eyed me suspiciously, then continued in stride. We hopped on his snowmobile and drove to the den. I nodded. There were a bunch of wolves and this man watching them. Herb tells me the guy is the professor. As we got closer, you could see that something was wrong with his face. Genital hemangioma. Is that what it's called? I nodded. A girl in my high school had something similar. Hard way to go through life. I concurred. Going through life like that, everyone staring at you, kids calling you a monster, it would be difficult. I could see why he chose the life of a wolf. Wolves didn't judge him, didn't cross the street when they saw him, didn't see him and thank God they didn't have what he had. You deal with enough of these sickos, and I'm not saying that you understand. To understand is impossible, but you can see why. Your dad locks you in the basement, or your uncle wants to play hide the pickle, or your mom makes you stick your hands in boiling water, or one of your foster parents likes to make you watch Full House reruns. You're going to end up fucked up. There wasn't a day in the professor's life that he didn't think about the red plague taking up the better side of his face. He probably considered just ending it 100 times, 1,000,000 times. But he hadn't. He decided to end Ellen Gray's life and Riley Peterson's. And for those 2 reasons, I was going to kill him. For those 2 reasons, I was going to make him suffer. Thomas, I looked up. Erica was staring at me. Sorry, keep going. Well, Herb, he yelled at the professor. He looked our way, then finally walked over. I told him who I was. Did he say anything? No. Yeah, he doesn't talk much. No, he doesn't. I told him I needed him to come down to the station for questioning. He nodded that he understood, then walked to the small building. He was in the building for about 5 minutes, and I was set to go check on him when he walked out the front door. You could tell right away something was off. It happened so fast. Before I knew it, Herb had a dart sticking in his chest, and I had one in my thigh. Erica weighed about 110, about the same as an adult wolf. She probably was out like a light within 10 seconds, but it couldn't have had much effect on Herb. Probably made him a little dizzy, or high. But a single dart wouldn't have knocked out a 250-plus-pound man, which is exactly the reason Herb was dead. He'd probably been hit by the dart, started to get dizzy but shook it off, then made for the snowmobile. That's when the wolves had pounced. I asked, how long were you out for? I have no idea. When I came to, I was handcuffed in one of the stalls. I've been there for 1.5 days. I think you know the rest. Thomas Prescott saves the day and gets the girl. More like Thomas Prescott lights the barn on fire, gets shot at, hides in a snow cave, gets hypothermia, then gets eaten by hungry wolves. Spoil the ending, why don't you? We both got a good laugh out of this. I asked, but does he get the girl? Of course he gets the girl. This led to another round of kissing. I was rounding second when a heart-stopping sound rolled through the mountains, a deep guttural howl. Chills crept up my spine. They were out there, and they were hunting us. I said, let's go. She nodded. We stood and started picking our way through the trees until we came to a large clearing. A valley, not a tree in sight. Eric and I glanced at one another. I think the same thought filled both our heads. The last thing we wanted to do was get caught out in the open and be run down by a pack of wolves. It would be certain death. Here in the trees, we at least stood a fighting chance. Not to mention we could always climb a tree. But who knew how long we could be out here before we were saved? I didn't want to get treed by these wolves, only to have the professor come pick us off like the first level of duck hunt. I was weighing the pros and cons when another round of howls filled the cold night air. When the echo ran its course, Erica said, they haven't moved. I agreed. They sounded as if they either hadn't moved or were headed in the opposite direction. I looked out on the large clearing and made some quick tabulations. I figured if we did it at a reasonable pace, we could traverse the clearing in 10 minutes. 6 or 7 minutes if we really hustled. I looked at Erica. She nodded, and we started across. The snow was the deepest we'd come across, and it took us 10 minutes to reach no man's land, or more accurately, the point of no return. I turned around. The sun was just beginning to wake, and everything was cast in a perfect gray. If not for the incredible glare coming off the snow, I would imagine it was a breathtaking landscape. We hit the three-quarter mark and I started to relax a bit. We had, give or take, the distance of a short par three until we reached the haven of the thick trees. Erica looked my way and gave me a little smile. I smiled back. That's when we heard it. A noise far more frightening than the howl of a wolf. It was the whir of a snowmobile. I turned and looked over my shoulder. Under the cover of the sun's glare, I could just make out the snowmobile's running light, moving diligently through the trees. The professor would reach the edge of the clearing in a matter of seconds, and in the open field, he would be on us in well under a minute. I looked at Erica and screamed, "Run!" We ran, if you could call it running. It was like trying to move through 3 feet of molasses. I could hear the snowmobile closing in. I looked over my shoulder again. The professor had reached the clearing. I turned back around. The trees were still 50 yards off. I heard a slight puff to my left and saw Erica was face first in the snow. I yanked her up, giving the professor a quick glance in the process. He had started into the clearing and the bright running light of the snowmobile was coming at us fast. We trudged on. My heartbeat was running somewhere in the low 400s. The snow's depth was receding slightly, plus there was a small decline, and we made good time the next 15 seconds. With just 20 yards left, I could feel the snowmobile rumbling through the snow, the whir coming from directly behind me. I visualized the gun trained between my L4 and L5 vertebrae, and I waited for the bullet to come. It never did. I turned around just in time to see the snowmobile blow past me. I pulled Erica behind me as it skidded 10 yards ahead of us and stopped. The front running light and snow glare were blinding, but I assumed the professor had the gun leveled at our chests. The engine on the snowmobile cut, carried away by the wind. Then the professor said his first words, "Don't move!" I looked at Erica. I didn't think the professor could talk. The running light on the snowmobile flicked off and the man yelled, "Let her go!" Erica and I looked at one another. Then at the man standing on the snowmobile holding his .45 pointed at my chest. It was Ethan. Chapter 50. Erica took a step forward and said, "What are you doing here?" Ethan hopped off the snowmobile, the gun pointed somewhere between my left ventricle and my right atrium. He shouted, "Walk to me, Erica." She looked at me, then at Ethan, and it finally dawned on her that Ethan Cates was under the impression the strange man in the neon leotard had kidnapped her, although there's a good chance Ethan would still be leveling the gun at my chest had he known it was me. Erica said, "I'm fine." She pointed to me and said, "That's Thomas." "Thomas?" I lifted my goggles and said, "Remember me? I thought you went to France." I couldn't help but notice that he hadn't lowered his gun. Well, actually, he'd lowered it from my chest to my balls. "Technically, I did go to France," I added. "If you ever go, make sure you check out the gift shop in the east wing of the airport. It's a thing of beauty." Ethan looked at me and said, "You reneged on our deal." "I did. I'll be speaking to the DA tomorrow, and I can assure you that you will do jail time." I'd pretty much come to terms with this already. Maybe 6 months in county would be good for me. I mean, my knowledge of petroleum jelly was negligible. "Hey, you gotta do what you gotta do," he nodded. Ethan said, "So this whole thing was about wolves." Eric and I both gave him a strained glance. "Oh, it wasn't that difficult. After I put together why Thomas had visited the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Building, it all came together quite nicely. I even did a bit of background on Ellen Gray. Talked to her folks. Apparently, she once had a little brother. They actually didn't know about all the great strides their daughter had taken to ensure that wolves were never relocated to the great state of Washington. Mom even choked up a little bit. I did a bit of background on this Professor Coble. Ellen actually had a restraining order against the man after an altercation at Pike Market. He wasn't allowed within 100 yards of her, and he had a record. He bit one of his students during his last year of teaching." I scoffed. "Did you say he bit one of his students?" "According to the report, one of his students called him a freak, and the professor latched onto his shoulder. Kid had to get 5 stitches. Professor resigned 2 days later." Erica asked, "How did you find us?" "I've been driving around on the snowmobile for about 6 hours. When I saw the smoke from the fire, I headed in that direction." I said, "And then he started shooting at us. I thought you were the professor." How ironic. And here I thought he was the professor. "Well, I'm glad we got that little misunderstanding resolved," he grinned. I'm not sure he felt the same way. I think he would have preferred the county coroner to point out the small error. After a cleansing breath, I asked, "So do you still think I killed Riley Peterson?"
"No, I don't.
I think the professor saw that you were poking around too closely and wanted to get you out of the mix. So I figured the professor killed her and framed you for the murder."
He paused.
"This doesn't mean that you're off the hook. I told you the second I saw you to keep your nose out of this business. You hampered an ongoing investigation. Would you be here right now if I hadn't? That's neither here nor there. No, actually, that's here. Actually, you, me, and Erica are here." He shrugged, then said to Erica, "So how did you put it all together?" Erica spent the next 5 minutes narrating the events that led up to her involvement, kidnap, rescue, and chase. She left out a couple parts, or one part, or the best part, which is probably a good thing, seeing as how Ethan could still shoot me and no one would ever be the wiser. Ethan nodded along as Erica wrapped things up. Then the three of us stopped, froze. A howl filled the silence. It was much louder than before. All of us turned and squinted at the tree line where Ethan had just come from. A shape darted from the trees into the open, quickly followed by several others. They'd found us. We watched as the wolves moved fluidly through the thick snow, their outstretched bodies gliding, then spraying up snow, then gliding once more. We had maybe 2 minutes. I pushed Erica forward and said, "Let's get out of here." Ethan jumped behind the wheel of the snowmobile. As Erica and I approached the sled, it quickly became evident the snowmobile was the compact model. Two people would be pushing it. Three would be utterly impossible. Ethan turned to Erica and said, "Get on." She looked at me and I nodded. She didn't move. I looked over my shoulder. The wolves were at about the quarter mark, kicking up all kinds of snow. Ethan repeated, "Erica, get on the snowmobile." I moved her to the back of the sled and said, "Don't worry about me. I'll be fine. For the record, I would be dinner. I'll climb a tree or something, and you can come back for me." I had another power bar I hadn't told her about. I glanced in the direction of the wolves. Some of the pups had lagged behind, but the adults were in a tight formation. Five big wolves, coming to eat me. I said, "Please get on the snowmobile." She shook her head, and I saw tears form in her eyes. I grabbed her shoulders and yelled, "Erica, get on the fucking snowmobile." She reluctantly started to move. She settled in behind Ethan and wrapped her arms around him. Then she said to Ethan, "Give him your backup piece." He shook his head. "I didn't bring a backup." I could see by the bulge of his ankle that he had indeed packed his backup, but I only had about 100, maybe 150 heartbeats remaining, and I didn't want to spend them quibbling over such trivial matters. Erica grabbed me around the neck and whispered in my ear. Had I not been about to be eaten by 11 angry wolves, I might have said it back. I broke away from her and said more to Ethan than her, "Drive." Ethan nodded and hit the gas. Erica gazed at me as they took a sharp right and went quickly down the mountain. I turned. The wolves were about 2 football fields away. I could see Cujo out in front leading the pack. I started running. Chapter 51. I made my way into the trees and immediately started looking for a tree to climb. The majority of the trees were covered in snow and would be impossible to get a foothold. I found what seemed a suitable tree and stopped. I wrapped my arms around the back, but the bark was wet and there wasn't a chance in hell I would make it up in time. I gave a sideways look and yelled, "Shit." Cujo was close enough that I could see his snarling teeth. He would be in the trees in the next 10 seconds. I whipped my head back and forth, surveying the trees for any haven, anything I could climb in or climb up. There was a small clearing 20 yards away, with a large white mound at center, a big boulder covered by the snow. If I could somehow find my way up the rock, I might be safe. I noticed a good-sized stick on the ground and picked it up. I broke it in two and took off in direction of the rock. My legs were pumping at an impossible pace. The mound was 10 yards away, then 5. I made it to the boulder. It was larger than at first glance, about 10 feet high, with nearly straight sides, a giant square. I dug my hands into the thick snow and tried to find a fingerhold. The rock was smooth. I gave a couple half-hearted leaps, but the effort was futile. Finally, I took a long, deep breath and turned around. Cujo was already in the air, his large mouth open, his huge white teeth agape. He hit me in the right shoulder, clamping down 400 pounds of pressure into my deltoid. If it weren't for the rock behind me, I would have been knocked back 10 feet. I hit the rock hard, the back of my head taking the brunt of it. A flash of white light played over my eyes, and I prayed I'd just died. but death was a long way off. I envisioned the deer, Bambi, basically eaten alive, the deer's heart beating, its eyes and brain taking in everything as it lay there conscious, until finally one of the wolves had ripped out its jugular. Only then had it died. I thought of Ellen Gray's ragged corpse, nearly ripped to shreds, and then Herb. Herb was relegated to nothing more than a couple bones and a hat.
The snarling of the wolves brought me back. I had the two sticks in my hands, and I pondered jamming one into my temple, ending it on my own terms. The thought was fleeting. Cujo was latched onto my shoulder, ripping this way and that. I squeezed the stick in my left hand and screamed.